Good morning, y'all. It's really, really good to see you. There it is. Now you know what I'm saying. It's really, really good to see you. I'm very, very thankful to have the opportunity to be here today, to be able to worship with you truthfully in this room, in person. Am I going to have to shout the whole time? I can do it, but it'll wear me out. It's really good to see you. And to be able to be here together today and to worship God together. Brother Don mentioned that some things have changed in my life since the last time that you saw me. I think that was February of 19 was the last time that we were here. And so it's been a year of changes for us. We've added another little boy to our family. His name is Truett, by the way. There's no connection to Truex in that. It's not meant to sound like that, no matter what Don tries to convince you of. Actually, the other thing, it occurred to me as he was talking a few minutes ago and kind of running through all of that, it occurred to me the numbers don't add up, Brother Don. Because I think if I had been in those places preaching for the amount of time that you said, I would be like almost your age by now. And that just doesn't add up. So it hasn't been that long since I've been gone, but it is just nice, really, really nice to be back here. I say it, I think, every time that I come. And every time I get a chance to speak from this pulpit, and I mean it every single time, it feels like coming home to come and be with this congregation. And I'm so, so thankful for what each of you individually, those of you that have been here especially for a long time, for what each of you have meant in my life and the formative influences that you've been on me. And I'm thankful that you've given me the opportunity to speak the word and hopefully to be a positive influence in your spiritual life as well. So I say that to say I am just really, really happy to be here today. And I mean that sincerely. It's just a joy. Have you ever seen any of those videos on YouTube? People that try those upside down goggles? Right? You can buy these actually on Etsy. These pair on the screen can be yours for only $102. You put these goggles on and it inverts your view of the world 180 degrees. And so what happens with these, a lot of people have done this experiment where you'll put them on and you wear these goggles every waking moment for, you know, however long the experiment is set for. Some people will do this for 2 or 3 days and see if they can function. Some people will do this for multiple weeks and see how their brain, how their body will respond to seeing the world upside down. Now, the results of this are both hilarious and very impressive, right? Because the first minute that somebody puts that on, you would expect, it works exactly as you would expect. Even the simplest task, like pouring a glass of water, you literally don't know which way is up. And it's really hard to orient to make sure that what you're seeing, that water goes this way instead of this way. It's just very difficult to figure it out. And that's the hilarious part of it. But the impressive part of this little experiment is what happens after these people wear these goggles for about 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, a week, something like that, is that after a little while, the brain just starts to compensate. And for most people, after they've worn these things that have shown them the world upside down for 5 days or a week, they function completely normally with their view being inverted. And so people are able to balance on a bicycle. And they're able to do very complex tasks with their hands, working Rubik's cubes and stuff like that, even though their view is now upside down. Now, the other very impressive and very cool part of that is, after they've done that for a little while and after they've gotten used to seeing the world upside down and functioning in it, most of the time when they take the goggles off, they spend the first hour or two completely disoriented again because the world now seems re-upside down, right? It's really fun to watch. If you haven't checked out any of the videos, they are all over YouTube, and you should check them out because it is an impressive thing to see how the brain can compensate to looking at things that you're completely used to seeing from a completely upside-down perspective. It's really fascinating to see how the brain can compensate for that. Now, you see where I'm going with that, don't you? You see the connections in that to our walk with God, right? Because when we first put on Christ, Christ becomes the filter through which we see the world. And I think if my own experience and the experiences that others have told me about holds true for most people, When we first do that, there are a lot of things that just suddenly look upside down to us. There's a lot of things that suddenly look like it shouldn't be that way. And yet over time, our minds and especially our hearts start to be able to function not only, you know, okay in this upside down view of the world, but they start to be able to function actually even better as we start to realize that the view that God gives us of the world is not the upside down view. It's right. It's the right way up. And we've been seeing it upside down all along. The world, though, will still tell us that we are looking at things the wrong way up. And to that we say, yeah, we are. Because that's how God has taught us to view the world. And so that's what I want to talk to you about this week. That's our theme. Because I want to just give us some reminders that I think, to the world's perspective, they're going to sound like, no, that's wrong, that's backwards, that's upside down. That's not the way you should be thinking about life as it is right now. But for us, we're able to take that view of the world, that yes, it seems upside down to the world, but it reminds us that reality has always been in God's control, and it will always be in God's control. Now, I think it's remarkable that he's been teaching us to do that for such a long time. Matter of fact, so long that this morning I want us to start our study all the way back in the Ten Commandments. Because as far back as the Ten Commandments, and if you want to be opening your Bible, you can be on your way to Exodus chapter 20 for that. As far back as the Ten Commandments, God has been teaching his people to view the world upside down, so that we can learn to actually see right side up. And I want to show you that, as I say, from these 10. And I want to do that this morning, beginning with, as Paul instructed Timothy, a public reading of Scripture. I want to read the entirety of the 10 Commandments to you this morning. And then we'll spend the rest of our time discussing just the first of the 10. All right, let's begin in Exodus chapter 20. I'm going to begin in verse 1. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant, or your livestock, or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female servant or his ox or his donkey or anything that is your neighbor's. The Ten Commandments. It's interesting to me that those 10, simple as seeming as they are, they serve as the preamble to more than 600 other commandments that you will read in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And they are 10 eternal principles. Yes, even the Sabbath principle. They are 10 eternal principles that have stood the test of time and endure, at least in principle, if not in application, even into our covenant with Jesus Christ today. And there are two foundational things that I really want you to think about in terms of the Ten Commandments that really make them important. there are two things, before I even get to fully hear the first commandment, there are two things that I want you to consider about them. Number one is what verse 1 says in Exodus chapter 20. You still have it open? Take a look at it. Verse 1, we typically skip right over that because we start reading with, "You shall have no other gods before me." But it's a foundational idea right there in verse 1 that God spoke all these words. Where are the Ten Commandments from? Are they from Moses? Are they from a brain trust of anti-Egypt revolutionaries? Are they from the world's most renowned philosophers of the time? No, God spoke all these words. And that makes them important. And it means that we should be paying attention to them. And the second thing that I want you to realize, it's a foundational idea to the Ten Commandments, is when they were spoken. Take a look now at verse 2 of Exodus chapter 20. In Exodus chapter 20 and verse 2, he reminds them a very short history lesson. "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the house of slavery in the land of Egypt." Now that's important to remember, because when God speaks these words at Mount Sinai, it's only been 2 months since they walked through the most powerful borders on the planet. They have been a free people for 2 months. Now, what do you know about societies that have just been free, about a whole group of people that has just become free in some way? Are they very likely to be a well-oiled machine, a functioning society that's thriving? No, usually without some sort of governance, they are likely to go back into the slavery of their own impulses. And so what God is giving them here is, number one, a statement of who He is and who they are hearing and who they are following. And number two, He's giving them guidelines that are going to make them not only a ragtag bunch of freed slaves, but a model society, a godly group of people to whom other societies will look for centuries as the model of what good people should be. And so since it is true that God spoke all these words, and since it is true that God spoke these words in order to help His people fully realize their freedom, it makes perfect sense that the first commandment this God gives is, "You shall have no other gods before me." Now, I know that that's where we typically start with the Ten Commandments, because that one is a command. In the English language, that's how it functions. It is a command, an affirmative, directive statement. However, what I want to do with this, what I want to do with our study this morning, is I want to make sure that we take in the whole of the first commandment. Because the first commandment begins not just with the imperative statement in verse 3, it begins with what is stated in verse 2 of Exodus chapter 20, so that the whole of the first of the Ten Commandments reads like this: "I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me." Now, I think when you see the context of the whole statement, you can recognize that there are really two things that are going on here. The first is an indicative. The second is an imperative. I'm sorry for the semi-snooty vocabulary right there, but it's worth it this time because it helps us to see what's going on. An indicative is a statement of what is. It is true. An imperative is a command for what ought to be. And both of those are present in the first of the Ten Commandments. And so let's take a look at both of them very quickly. The indicative is the seemingly simple statement where God tells His name, "I am Yahweh your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery." Now, I know that sounds really simple, but I think it's very important for us to realize the gravity of hearing God give His identity, in fact, giving His name. This, brothers and sisters, even though we tend to skip over it, this is the most foundational idea in the wording of the Ten Commandments. That I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of the house of slavery. Now, we may not realize it, but just in the fact that He has given His name, and in calling Himself by that name, God has basically already declared, "I must be your only God." You remember what the name Yahweh means, right? Remember from Moses' encounter with God at the burning bush? And He says, "When the people ask me, 'Who is sending you to release us from Egypt?' what should I tell them?" And God says, "Tell them, I am. Yahweh has sent you." His name is, "I am who I am."
And I think that's an interesting thing there, because it's a very unique use of language that we don't have it in English, right? It doesn't come across in English the same way that it does in Hebrew. Because when we say that I am, right, you am in this room right now. You am right here. Some of you are cringing every time I do that. It's going to get worse. Hold on, okay? But you am here right now. And you be right now. You exist in this time, in this place. But God, when he says I am, he doesn't mean that I am here. It's not that specific. He doesn't mean that I am now. It's not that specific. It is I am. I am always, everywhere. When God says his name is I am. And just by saying that, he has already made himself unique among all the other gods that mankind may worship throughout time. Because is there any other God who is beyond an origin story? Is there any other God of whom it can be said that God just is? No, you know, every civilization that has worshipped other gods has the story of how their gods came to be. But not Judaism, and not Christianity that has taken on that same legacy. We don't have that story because God just is. And just in that, there are. Not only must there not be any other gods before him, but he's already stated there are no other gods before this God. He is the only God, and he is completely, utterly unique. And then that makes sense, I think, of the second half of the command, the part that we are used to as a directive, as a command. That God brought his people out of slavery, and therefore they shall have no other gods before him. It's actually something interesting and worth thinking about right there as well. Because, you know what's interesting, also interesting to me about this whole indicative thing? Is that God doesn't say to his people, I'm God and I made everything, so you better obey me or else. You know, he could begin the Ten Commandments that way, couldn't he? It would be a valid statement. I'm God. I made everything. Obey me or else. But he doesn't do that. Because what he's focused on is their relationship. He says, I am the God who has cared about you, who has redeemed you, and who is bringing you to myself. Yahweh God, brothers and sisters, is the only God who gives people freedom. Is the only God who cares about people altruistically, in a way that is not serving himself, it is serving us. There is no other God who does that, and we'll revisit that idea in just a few minutes. But let's go ahead and move on to the second part of this commandment here, the imperative, that because those things are true, this then is what must take place, that you shall have no other gods before me. Now, I think just in that, there are two ideas built in right there as well. Number one is a contrast. The first is a contrast, that there shall be no other gods who, in our estimation, are higher than Yahweh God. There is no other God that gets grander worship or receives glory in a higher way than we give glory to Yahweh, our God. And the second part of that is a comparison, where there is not to be any God alongside Yahweh, the God whom the people of Israel worship. There are no others whom the people may worship as being equal with God, because there are no other gods who are equal with Yahweh God. And I think all of that makes perfect sense when you look at who is speaking here, that God spoke all these words. Now, I know that the Ten Commandments are given for the people of Israel, and I know that they were a national law specifically given to them, but I also know from the rest of the Bible and from the rest of the extrapolation of these principles, that this idea is one that is meant to be important to God's people in every era. In that their words, their money, their actions, their lives, their time, their worship, their whole hearts belong to this God. This, by the way, is why Judaism is held up as the class example of monotheism. Mono, one. Theism, the belief in God. Put it together, the belief in one God. Judaism is the class example of that. And Christianity takes that same legacy. And we live out that same legacy that we have inherited from our Jewish forebears. We, too, are monotheistic people. We are to be people, brothers and sisters, who are firmly committed to the truth that God Himself spoke when He said, I am Yahweh your God. You shall have no other gods before me. So does the first of the ten commandments have relevance in the modern world, in the lives that we live in Jesus Christ? Yeah. Yeah, it definitely does. We get warnings all over the New Testament to abstain from worshiping other gods, don't we? We're reminded that covetousness is idolatry. We're told in one of the letters to flee from idolatry. Well, little children, abstain from idols, John said to his readers. And so, yes, it has relevance for us. We are warned constantly not to give our lives to the worship of other gods. And yes, I do think that throughout time that has, and different places, that has meant don't bow down to a statue. And by the way, that sort of thing still happens. There are places across the face of the globe where that sort of thing is still commonplace. There are places here in your city where that sort of thing is still done. And so let's not think that this is a commandment for ancient primitive peoples. This is a commandment for people everywhere, not to give your allegiance to some sort of image made to in the likeness of a god. But I think, if I'm estimating us rightly, I think that we need to spend a little bit more of our attention making sure that we don't worship the things that our society tempts us to elevate to God status. Because I think even with minimal reflection on our lives and our culture, it's pretty easy to see that we live in and around a world that is still very much serving other gods. And there are a couple of well-worn paths for applications when we talk about how that actually plays out in our lives. The preacher that I heard through most of my formative years, through middle school and high school, he would talk frequently about how the amount of time that we as a society spend watching our TVs, staring into the electronic abyss, it can be compared to the amount of time that ancient civilizations would spend worshiping their gods in their temples at the idols. And you know what? I think he has a valid point there to make about that. We can make the same application to our phones and our tablets, couldn't we? Okay? And another one that he talked about quite a bit when he talked about idolatry was he said that it's very easy for us to make an idol out of our careers or out of our money. That if we spend our time devoted to that, and we choose that over times of worship or times that we could be with people, we devote ourselves to that instead of to our families, then yeah, we could be making that an idol in place of worship of the true God. But that said, can I tell you what I think are the idols that are far more dangerous in our time? I think like all of history's most dangerous idols, the gods that are the most tempting to us are gods of ideas. They're not gods that are worshipped necessarily at a particular place with a particular image in a particular manner. They are gods that are gods of ideas. And so we are tempted, I think, to serve some of these gods, like the gods of status and popularity. We're tempted to serve these gods. They are powerful gods in our time. And they're served by several powerful underlings, like the god of non-confrontation. Right? We don't want to cause a conflict with somebody if we talk about the God whom we truly serve. So let's just give in to this god and keep things comfortable. Or the god of acquiescence, the god of cowardice. Sometimes this god is served, the underlings that serve this god are the gods of sexual immorality and status and sexiness. The gods who have been described as the gods of good health, good hair, and good humor, right? I don't know much about good hair, but it's a thing. And our temptation to serve these gods, it runs actually fairly deep. Right? It runs deep. You can see it in all sorts of things, both big and small, that we are tempted to serve the gods of us looking good. And that God, brothers and sisters, is not the same as serving Yahweh God. But we're tempted to serve it. We're tempted to serve the gods of safety and comfort. We're tempted to serve the gods that mean we can live a life with no risks, that Christianity will be a peaceful and quiet life for us. Can I just remind you, brothers and sisters, that in the passage that uses that phrase, lead a peaceful and quiet life, what it says is pray for your leaders so that they may grant you the opportunity to live a peaceful and quiet life. But can I also remind you that the life stories of people who have lived their lives for Christ have often been anything but peaceful and quiet? Because they weren't serving peace and quiet, they were serving God. And there's a difference between those. One will lead to the other in many cases, but you can't switch them. If we switch them and we try to serve the one in place of the other, serve these gods of safety and comfort in place of Yahweh, we will not serve Yahweh. I think we're also tempted to serve the gods of entertainment and pleasure in our time. Whatever we're doing, we want it to be engaging, right? It's got to be engaging. It's got to be exciting. It's got to be challenging, maybe, but as long as it's engaging, that's the main thing. It's kind of like people that say, and I actually heard somebody say this yesterday, I'm going to call him out on it. It's like people that say, you know, I don't like to run unless I have a ball to chase, right? If I'm playing a sport, then I'll run, but I don't like to just get out there and run. It's so boring. Well, first of all, what's the matter with you? And then second of all, I love running. I do now anyway. But second of all, that's harmless enough in the area of sports, right? But take that same mentality and put it in the realm of worship. I don't know. I don't really like going to church unless it's engaging, unless it's relevant, unless there's something for every age demographic, unless there's something for the kids, unless there's that one thing that I need right now today. I don't really like just going for the sake of going. Well, going for the sake of worshiping God, that's a bit of a different thing than going for the sake of, will it be engaging? You see the difference? You see how we find ourselves serving the God of entertainment and pleasure and enjoyment and engagement and not focused on serving Yahweh God? Ultimately, all of these boil down to the same thing. They all come down to the fact that we are serving the God of self. And when we serve any other god, that's ultimately what we're doing. We're serving the god of self. And the problem with that god and the problem with any false god, anyone other than Yahweh God, is that those gods will always enslave us. I said this a little while ago. I said we would revisit this idea, and that's what we're doing right now, that Yahweh God is the only God who gives his people freedom. He did that when he released the people of Israel from slavery in Egypt, and he does that for us. But every other god, brothers and sisters, is out to enslave humanity. If we serve the gods of our own passions, they are masters that can never be satisfied. If we serve the gods of our doubts, we become slaves to a master that is always just out of reach. If we serve the gods of money, it's a master that will leave us high and dry when we most need it. Every time. If we serve the gods of the whims of the world, that is a master that is always changing, unpredictable. You'll never be able to you'll never have anything solid to hang on to. Or if we serve the gods of a human nation or government, if we elevate them above the status of God, that is a master that will inevitably disappoint us and often oppress us. And so, we must make it a firm determination that in our lives, in every culture, in every time, God's people worship God alone. One of my mentors, whom you know well, is wont to say that an idol is anything which holds your heart. And he's 100% right about that. That if there's anything to which our heart is more devoted than God, whether it's someone else's love or money or status or health or adventure or excitement or something like that, if there is anything that is our treasure in this life above how we treasure God, it will inevitably distract us from the true freedom and blessing that we could have if we worship Him alone. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. Now, there's one more way that I think we can find ourselves falling short of the great spiritual mandate that God gave to Israel and by extension to us in this first commandment. There is another form of idolatry, another facet of idolatry that we need to be aware of, and I'll make this quick, but it's important, y'all. We need to be aware that we are very often tempted to heed other gods. We're very often tempted to give the attention of our ears and our hearts and our minds to the God of this world, whom the New Testament tells us blinds the minds of men. I know in myself, I know that we are tempted, whether we like to admit it or not, to put more stock in and give more attention to the world's voices than we are to God's voice. Which is a shame, because the apostles set out in the world to teach people that they could take every thought captive to Christ. That's what they set out to do, and it ought to be still what we are setting out to do, to help people take every thought captive to Christ. But if we can't do that in ourselves, we're not going to have the tools to do that for other people. And so we need to make sure that instead of letting our thoughts and our hearts and our minds be heeding the gods who bring us into captivity and who show us only darkness and confusion, instead of letting our minds be given to the gods that only give us weariness and hopelessness and fear, that we give our hearts and we give our ears, our attention and our devotion to the one God who has reliably promised to tell us the truth, to grant us peace, to give us comfort, and to never disappoint us with the hope that He offers. And maybe the one that all of us have craved the most desperately throughout this very weird year, we ought to make sure that we are listening to the one God who has reliably promised to give us joy. There is one God who can be trusted to bestow that on His people. And Christians, above all other people, should rise above the temptation to give in to fear. Because when we give ourselves to fear, when we heed the terrifying voices that speak to us in the world, we're not heeding the voice of God that would speak to us in the Word. Now, Dan, does that mean that we shouldn't feel afraid of what might happen in a time like what we're living in right now? Dan, does that mean that we just shouldn't be concerned about what a worldwide pandemic might do to society or what the racial hostility in our country might bring about for us? Does that mean that we shouldn't be afraid of losing our money, losing our jobs, and the status of the peaceful world that we are used to living in? Are you saying we shouldn't be afraid of those things? Yes. Yes, that's what I'm saying. Because we serve God. And we serve the God who is still on His throne. No matter what transpires down here, He still sits there. And praise His name that He has given us His promises, that we can trust Him and that we can live with joy in spite of what's happening around us. Now, does that mean we should be careless and unprepared for the things of life? No, it doesn't mean that. Make the necessary preparations. Be wise in the world as God has taught you to be. Yes, do those things. But don't do them out of paranoia. Don't do them out of fear. Do them out of wisdom and from a place that trusts in our God. Now, in our time, like God's people have done in every time, we must make a deliberate choice to give more of our attention to the things of God than to any disease or any shutdown or any news outlet or any political conflict or any government leader. We are called to a higher order of thinking than just survival mode. We are called to serve and worship the exalted, mighty God of all creation. And so we do, because He is Yahweh our God, who has brought us out of the house of slavery, and so we shall have no other gods before Him. Jesus said that the most important command is this one: Hear, O Israel, the Lord Yahweh our God, Yahweh is one. And you shall love Yahweh your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength. It's a command that echoes with the sentiment and with the theology of the first of the Ten Commandments. And if we are willing to heed it, it will set us free from the bondage of sin and self and hopelessness and fear. And it will help us to have no other gods before Yahweh, who has brought us out of the house of slavery. May God give strength to His people to continue to keep this fundamental command in our generation and in every generation. Amen. The prophet Isaiah got a glimpse of God sitting on His throne in the temple on Zion. And the beginning of that story about Isaiah seeing God in the temple, it starts by telling us that it happened in the year that King Uzziah died. King Uzziah was well loved, he was well respected, and he reigned for a very long time. And like things typically go, you can imagine that once a throne that's been occupied for a long time is suddenly empty, you can expect there's going to be a little uneasiness about what might happen next, right? But here's what I love about the story. When Isaiah saw God in the temple, it starts by saying this: In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on His throne, high and lifted up. That's what we need to remember in every generation, brothers and sisters, that He is still on His throne, and praise His name for that. If you're ready to make sure that He is the only God in your life to whom you want to give your allegiance and serve with everything in your being, then I would love to talk to you about what that means, what that looks like, and how you can start that journey right now. And if you want to come and talk to me, you can do that while we're standing together and singing this hymn.